Notice on the back of your outline, questions for preparation next week. Refer not to Genesis chapter 3, but to 3 John. Now you might well puzzle as to the relationship between Genesis and 3 John, that we're moving from chapter 2 to of Genesis to chapter 3, to the third epistle of John. That might puzzle you. All the more because most likely you don't know what's in the third epistle to John, of John. And so the deep significance and relationship is very hard to resolve. Let me share the light with you so that you can understand clearly. We'll be meeting here because, again, next week that lecture theatre is booked, and then for the rest of the session we should be meeting in that lecture theatre, which has the advantage that we've got it for the hour after this study too, so that we can stay on and talk fairly easily. But next week I've got to speak at a conference elsewhere. And so Tim is going to lead us in studies, and rather than get him to interrupt on the Genesis studies, we thought we'd pick on some particular topic that we're not likely to do in a series ever. And 3 John, as it consists of a whole of 13 verses, is a bit that we're not going to be normally putting into a series, and that is why it is for 3 John next week. You might like to pray for me in terms of that conference, which is with HSC students who are going away in a conference to study camp with, I think, the Crusader Union. And I thought it was helpful that if I meet up with them before they came to university, that might be an advantageous thing for them and for me. But you might like to pray for that. You also might like to pray for Tim as he works on 3 John, because as you read through it, you'll start to see the problems. If you do see connections between 3 John and Genesis, chapters 2 and 3, then I do hope you'll share them with Tim, because I don't think he's seen any yet, and I'm sure I haven't either, and it would be very helpful. When you look and think about mankind, about men, we are an enigma. Psalm 8 really picks up the enigmatic nature of man. Psalm 8 is a very famous one, and it's oft quoted, especially the phrase, "When I consider your heavens, the works of your fingers, the moon, the stars which you have set in place, what is man that you are mindful of him? The son of man that you care for him. You made him a little lower than the heavenly beings and crowned him with glory and honour. You have made him ruler over the works of your hands. You put everything under his feet, all flocks and herd, beasts of the field, birds of the air, and fish of the sea, all that swim the paths of the seas." Hey, man's a great riddle. If you look upon us from some giddy height, we're not all that distinctive from an ant colony. Little insects rushing and pushing about, bustling our way here and there, filling this lecture theatre, emptying that lecture theatre, racing off to another lecture theatre, fill that, gathering together food that we consume down at great rates. I mean, we're just like a little ant colony, leaving behind our mess like they do too. But it's an industrious insect colony with a particular potential, isn't it? That it actually can put man into space, that it can fly hundreds of people in and out of cities in massive inventions called aeroplanes. Things of enormous size it can build. I mean, it might be an ant colony, but what an ant colony! Now, what is man? Compared to the stars, says the psalmist, we're but specks of dust, we're nothing. But compared to our position in the world, we are in dominion of the world. And yet, when the New Testament quotes Psalm 8, as it does in Hebrews chapter 2, it says, but the trouble is you don't see man in his dominion over the world. I mean, we have aeroplanes which can fly and flip around the world from here to there, but we're running out of the fuel to keep them going. And we find cracks in DC-10s, I understand. And we have air crashes, and thousands of people can get killed in just a few seconds. And we work even in this part of the world as free men, free women, but yet we work in such a way that we're in bondage to a system which we don't like. And we have great difficulty in having fellowship with each other. We're always at war and fighting with each other, disagreeing with each other in the home front, places of work, internationally, industrially. We do not seem to be really in control of the situation like it would appear that we should be. Now, these can be very modern issues. Of course, they're common problems for mankind, because our dominion fails everywhere. And we can give rise to particular questions. particularly two issues, that is of work and of marriage. In both of these, we see man, as he's created to be, the Bible would say, we see man in dominion, we see man with enormous potential. But in both of these, we see man in his unfulfilled potential, in his corruption, in his inability. He both loves work and he hates work. He loves marriage and he hates marriage. Everybody knocks the institution. Who would want to live in an institution? 97% of the community live in the same institution that they all knock. And indeed, those who divorce most frequently marry again. They don't like it, they can't cope with it, but they keep on going in for it. There's a love-hate relationship about marriage, about work, which is a puzzle of mankind. There's no way we can do full justice as Genesis 2 in this brief statement today. It's one of those chapters, like Genesis 1, that's pregnant with ideas. But it's an important chapter to deal with in certain lines, and I'm going to tease out just a couple of things, in particular work and marriage, as you'll see. But before I do that, let me point out three things about it. Firstly, the view of man that you get in Genesis 3 is a view of revelation. It is not the conclusions of empiricism or rationalism. That is, people haven't sat down and thought up, this is what man should be like. No one has thought up man like this. This is quite a different viewpoint of mankind than you will find anywhere else. And people do not run around and run surveys on mankind, and as a result of feeding the statistical information through computers, have come out with Genesis chapter 2. That is not what it's claiming either. And you can't run a historical examination and get back to Adam now and find out this is the way it was. What you have here is a revelation. Well, that's what it is claiming. There's no way I can observe this and know it to be true. God says this is the way it is. Now, I may see that reflected in this world today. In fact, I do. I see it so clearly reflected in this world today that it confirms to me the reasonableness of accepting the revelation. Second thing I want to say about it is Genesis 2 is part and parcel of Genesis 3. We've chopped them off in the chapters, and I've done it in studies, simply because we can't cope with the amount of information in one section. But what it really happens is that you get the setting in Genesis 2 and the action in Genesis 3. God sets up the garden, man in the garden in a particular position, etc. And in Genesis 3 you see man being expelled from the garden for his failure to fulfill the position God has given to him. The two go together. That is, we are given two options of life here in Genesis 2. We can have obedience and life, or we can have disobedience and death. But it's not till chapter 3 that we see the option being taken. And so we see that in the future study. However, in today's study I will be tickling over to chapter 3 on the assumption that most people know that Adam goofed. The third thing to say about Genesis 2 is that we have here a model for the future. The New Testament and the Old Testament use Genesis 2 as a picture of what man should be. And so in Isaiah chapter 11, you get a picture of the future beatific state of the paradise, the garden, where everything is harmony again. Or in Revelation chapter 2, you get a picture of heaven, which has got the tree of life in the centre of it and the garden around about. Revelation 2:7. And so last week I refrained from the activity of using Genesis 1 and chasing it through the rest of the Bible. This week I will not refrain. We actually will pick up Genesis 2 as an example of man before creation, or sorry, man as he's created rather, before the fall. Then we'll see the effects of the fall, and then we'll talk about the recreation in the end stage when the garden is restored. And we'll do it, as you'll see in the notes, under work and marriage in particular. But before we do that, we'll have one broad sweep about man in creation so as to give the backdrop to the statements on marriage and work I'd like to make. Man in creation is like this. We are created in the world in chapter 1 and chapter 2, and the two statements are saying the same things, only they say them quite differently. Indeed, there seem to be contradictions between chapters 1 and chapter 2. The animals come before mankind in chapter 1, man comes before the animals in chapter 2. The stories seem to be quite different. But the point they make are the same. So, in chapter 1, verse 26, God makes man in his image. That is, man is made. Man is a contingent being, I suggested last week. He is dependent upon God. And in chapter 2, verse 7, man is made by God, formed from the dust of the earth. He is a living being only because God breathes life into him, in 2:7. Secondly, in chapter 1, you find man is created as a unique part of creation. He is the Lord of creation, in God's image, and only in the creation is he in God's image. And in chapter 2, verse 8, man is created as the special Lord of the garden. He is the first one who is created. He is the one to whom is given the charge to till the garden and keep it in verse 15. He is the one to whom God speaks in verse 16. He is the one to whom is given all the fruit and the vegetation for food in verse 16. He is the one for whom the whole thing is created and for whom the animals are created. Man is the unique Lord of the garden in chapter 2, just as man is the unique Lord of the whole earth in chapter 1. And so this uniqueness, this being in the image of God, can be seen as a matter of being the underlords of creation. Chapter 1, I use that exact phrase, they are given dominion over the earth, was given to them. And in chapter 2, the garden is given to him to till it, to keep it, to have the animals, to name the animals. He names them as an expression of his lordship. So the picture you get of man in the world in chapter 1 and chapter 2 is the same, although the way in which it is described is quite radically different. When you look at man in the garden, just as chapter 1, man is in the centre of the picture. Man here is the centre of the garden under God. But notice what God does for him. He provides for him richly in a whole series of ways. It's a picture of abundance. It's a picture of paradise. There is aesthetic provision from God. See chapter 2, verse 9, where it says, "The Lord God made all kinds of trees grow out of the ground, trees that were pleasing to the eye, good for food." It's actually, the garden was a beautiful place. It was a place that for the eye, it was pleasing. You notice that God provides in the same verse 9, food, generously. Behold, the trees were good for food. And in verse 16, he commands that they may eat of any of the trees except for two, one in particular. But it's good for food. Thirdly, you notice there's an abundance of life there. Man is created as a living being by the breath of life. The tree of life is in the middle of the garden. The tree that as you eat of it, you will not die. As you can see from chapter 3, where they are cut away from the tree of life, lest they eat of it and live forever. There's no question of death in the garden, except as the consequence of disobedience. But God provides an earth which he richly nourishes by the rivers that flow around the garden. And you'll notice that the lands that are described there are rich and wealthy lands with gold and onyx and all those kinds of things. And the animals are there for man. God creates them. He creates them for man. He created them for man's need, and he places them under man's dominion. And all of them are created for man, and he names each one of them. Now the Lord God, verse 19, formed out of the ground all the beasts of the field and all the birds of the air, and he brought them to the man to see what he would name them. Whatever the man called each living creature, that it was his name. And God's concern for fellowship, God's concern that the man be not alone and lonely in the task, leads to the creation of the woman, so that the context of the garden is a context of fellowship. God fellowshipping with man fellowshipping with woman. And there is a harmony in the relationships between people. There are three levels, really. There is the relationship with God, there is the relationship of mankind, and there is the relationship of the animals. Now, the garden, then, is a rich provision. But also, man in the garden is created with responsibility. He is the part of creation to whom God speaks. And he is treated as a person with responsibility, with will. And he is not treated as an object. but as a person. And that treatment from God. It's not just that one person may treat another person as a person, but the Almighty Maker of man treats man as persons who are responsible. He is given work. His work to look after the garden, to till it, to keep it, to care for it. He is given the direction of restraint. He is to eat freely of all the trees, but not of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Now that tree is not defined for us. We're just told there's a tree of the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil. But what does it mean to have a tree of the knowledge of good and evil? It's a mouthful, isn't it? You can see why people go for apples. They're less of a mouthful, if you don't mind the pun. Now, next week we'll look at that in... next time when we look at Genesis 3, which is in about 3 weeks' time because we've got a mid-session break coming up. Relief, relief, joy, joy. But when we come to look at it, that is a critical point as to what that tree is. Let me foreshadow it for you now, although the point of it you may not grasp from just this short statement. That I take it that it's got to do with having the right to determine what is good and evil. It's not got anything to do with sex, as you will shortly see, if you didn't know beforehand. It has to do with determining what is good, what is evil. They are not to eat that tree. They're not told why they're not to eat the tree, they're just told not to eat it. But they are treated as responsible beings, in that God says, don't eat that. And he tells them the consequence of eating it. In the day they eat of it, they'll surely die. They're not to have it. And so we're treated as responsible beings, unlike the rest of creation in that extent. We're spoken to, we're directed to work, and we're given a prohibition. Now, you can take up many strands from that chapter. The relationship with animals is a very important one today, especially in the rising in mysticism, with its concurrent vegetarianism, with the writings against speciesism, against treating other species as lesser than ourselves. You could actually speak on the subject of aesthetics in the world. Indeed, people would want to do that. However, I'd like us to settle on these two issues of work and marriage because they're important issues. Most of us get involved in them. Well, most of us get married anyway. Because they're affected by Chapter 3 and there is current debate about marriage and about work because they're referred to in the rest of the Bible. They're all sufficient reasons, I thought, why you should choose these ones. So let's first start in on work. And you'll see the first title is Modern Man's Mondayitis. See, it is a right assessment of mankind to say that work is a difficult and unpleasant activity. That work creates within me some kind of alienation. It's a right thing to perceive. That I really find work intolerable. But I still keep doing it. I don't like it. I don't like getting out of bed to go and do it. But it's there. Now, you may not be like it. You may be one of the very, very chosen, privileged few in the world who finds it a joy to burst out of bed every morning and charge back into the books. You may be like that. But you're not normal. And it also comes from the fact of your particular social standing. You wouldn't feel the same way, I'm sure, if the job you're engaged in was of a more menial task, like the most of mankind. If you're part of the factory fodder, to use the current emotive terminology. See, I was working as a bus conductor over one Christmas vacation. I was a uni student. And they did have buses in those days. And I remember working with a bloke and we'd just got an increase to 6 weeks annual holiday. And he had just come back from his 6 weeks annual holiday. And I said, well, how'd it go? He said, I ran out of money. And I said, oh, that's a rough deal, isn't it? I said, that's one of the problems. He says, yes. He says, you don't get overtime pay because you didn't then. All you got was just the basic rate and I couldn't live on it, especially on holidays. I said, oh, that's rough, isn't it? I said, I suppose there's no point applying for a longer holiday then. That's the limit. He says, oh, no. He says, no, I'm going to keep militating, keep acting as long as we can to try and get it so that we only work 6 weeks a year and we have the rest on holidays. That is what people are like, isn't it? They spend their time at work contemplating their holidays. They spend each week discussing last weekend until Wednesday and next weekend until Friday. how to avoid it. They arrive at the very last minute and they queue up for some length of time in front of the bunty so they can get off as early as possible. And although you've got sick allowance, I mean you've got 6 days you can miss work each year because you're sick, you always make sure you are sick 6 days. And the terrible thing happens, of course, some days, some years, is that you do get sick and you've used up your time. Now, work is hard. It is unpleasant. However, as we have moved to a new stage in our economic progress, I suppose you could call it progress, it's hard to tell, as we move to a new stage where you've got fairly large-scale unemployment, we discover another truth. That is, that not working is worse. That to actually not be able to work, not to have a job, is a soul-destroying position to be in. It's decimating to you as a person. It really knocks the stuffing out of most people's self-confidence to find that nobody is interested in paying for their labour. That they are not worth anything. That their work is not worth anything. And it is a terrible thing to have hundreds and hundreds and thousands of people unable to get work. That is a terrible thing, not just because you can't pay for your trip to New Zealand because you won't be able to get a Chrissy job, but I mean to be permanently out of work and unable to find work is something which is a terrible blight on a man. Great difficulty for him to cope with. And you also see that unemployment is worse when you come to retirement. Because for most people, they don't want to retire. Oh, they want to when they're 20. It's when they're 60 they're not so sure they want to. And if they do, they usually die fairly quickly afterwards. Not just because they have reached the end of their lifespan, but because retirement seems to increase the rates of death. That is, people who keep on working after they're 65 continue to live longer than people who knock off at 65. And there's a great spate of people who die within the first 12 months of retirement. Now, there's a problem for you. There's a conundrum about man. Work. We hate it, and we can't live without it. Isn't that a strange thing? The Bible explains it like this. Work is not a consequence of the fall. Work is part of God's way for our lives. He has created us to work. It is part of the created order. It's part of being in paradise to work. The alienation view has a trouble at this point. But we are created in paradise as workers. That our dominion over the garden is a dominion of service. Take that phrase carefully. It's a dominion of service. See, what work is he put to in the garden? To till it, to care for it, to keep it. He's put in the garden to look after the garden. That is how he is to be the lord of the garden, by being the gardener. See, the gardener is the lord of the garden, isn't he? He is the one who determines where the roses grow and where the primulas grow and where the this and the that grow. He is the one who determines how well it is looked after. You can see his handiwork when you see his garden. You can see my lack of handiwork when you come and look at my garden. But it says something about the gardener, because the gardener is the lord of it, but the way he lords it is by caring for it and keeping it. When I use the word underlord or lord, most people think of it in terms of the after the fall event. But lordship in the Bible is always a view of service. Like in Philippians chapter 2, where Jesus comes to his lordship by being a servant. Or Mark 10, 45, you get it, where Jesus says the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and give his life as a ransom for many. And so he tells the disciples that the greatest amongst them will be the least, the first will be last. Because the way of Christian lordship is by service. You might also remember that in terms of marriage too, which we look at in a few moments, in Ephesians chapter 5, where the way in which the husband is to lord it over his wife is by serving her as her slave. That is how he lords it. It is by the exercise of a cup of tea in bed and other things. He's put in the garden then in dominion to till it, to keep it, to care for it, but also to use it in verse 16, to have its fruit. Yet that caring for the garden is never seen in chapter 2. It's not seen as a man's independent dominion over the garden. He is the under-gardener of the garden, if you like. Because he is under the real one who owns the garden. There's never any mistake about that in chapter 2, that God's garden it is. and that man has not got free rein over the garden. Indeed, there's one section he's not to touch at all. And you'll also notice that in his creation in work, God also creates man to rest. I suppose we missed it by not reading the first few verses, but God actually creates a rest day and a rest pattern. That man does not only work, man enjoys, man rests, and just as God rests, one day in seven. That pattern continues through the Bible, in the Ten Commandments, for example, or Psalm 104, verse 23, which talks about the way in which God creates man to be a working animal who works during the daylight and rests during the night time. We, of course, have created these electric monsters whereby we can now get the chooks to work 10 days a week. And also the humans, too. You just speed up their clocks and so on. Now, that is not the way. God creates man to work 6 days and to rest one day. And it's our problem that we keep on trying to change that pattern. You've got the problem, haven't you? So you come exam time, you try and work 8 days a week. It doesn't work. It'll never work. 7 days a week doesn't work either. And some of us have got the other pattern, of course. That is, we do have the 1 day a week off. It's the other 6 days working we don't do. God creates us in balance. Now, after the fall, after the garden, after man chooses to run things his way instead of God's way, and he is kicked out of the garden, work takes on a new attitude, a new aspect altogether. Work now becomes difficult. Chapter 3, verse 17 to 19, I read. To Adam, God said, "Because you listened to your wife and ate from the tree about which I commanded you, you must not eat of it. Cursed is the ground because of you. Through painful toil you will eat of it all the days of your life. It will produce thorns and thistles for you, and you will eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your brow you will eat your food until you return to the ground, since from it you are taken. For dust you are, and to dust you will return." Now the world is not one of plenty. Now he is not in a garden which gives freely. Now he's in a garden which is actually hard and hostile to his every improvements. Thorns and thistles come out of this garden now, rather than fruit. And his work is a work of sweat. That's not to say that he didn't perspire in the garden previously and he had a different anatomical structure. Maybe, but I understand if you don't sweat, you've got big problems.
Don't know what's saying. Not perspire, glow, or whatever is moistened, whatever is the appropriate phrase. But what it's saying now is that the work is difficult. The garden now will constantly call upon you to exert your energies and to tire yourself out of it, because it is no longer pleasant, it is no longer easy. And so man's work after the garden is not only difficult, but it becomes an area in which he seeks to live without God and distorts his work. His dominion is not one of service, but is rapacious. He is constantly tilling it and keeping it for his own good, rather than for the caring of the garden. He rips it off, he abuses it, he uses its resources and consumes them without ever replacing them. He moves into a world of ownership and abuse, as you see so currently around about us. And more than that, he worships the silly earth that he is so hard pressed to get his profit out of it. He actually uses it selfishly. He lives for it, as you see it classically in materialism, not recognizing that materialism is idolatry. We live our life for the fruit of the ground that we can produce. And we in our work seek to exercise our sinfulness, because we now seek every way possible to work as men pleases. I do as much work as the boss can catch me doing. And if he can go, if he doesn't come in every half hour to check up on me, I won't do very much. And that is how the public service and other parts of the working force operate. Indeed, that's how you operate, isn't it? I mean, it's all very well to say, let's not have assignments, but how much would you do if you didn't have an assignment? Judging by the fact that you write up the essay the night before, I'd say, sweet bother all if you didn't have a deadline on you. Take away the deadlines is murder, because you don't wind up ever doing anything. That's because we work as men pleasers now, not out of the enjoyment of the work, but so as to please the boss. And we all live under those bosses. And worse than that, We no longer enjoy our rest, because we constantly work and we constantly rest, and we neither enjoy one nor the other. It's like holiday time. You're coming up for the mid-session break. Now, let me tell you a great thing about mid-session breaks. If you're going to have a break, have a break. If you're going to work, work. But whatever you do, don't take your books on your holiday, because you won't have a holiday, because all the time you'll be worried about the books that you're not opening. And you won't get your work done because you're on holiday. And so you're neither holiday nor work. You just don't enjoy either. Far better to work for 3 days solidly and then take 3 days off.
than to carry your books on your holiday. I've carried books all over, all kinds of holidays. I never opened them, except to feel guilty. See, we constantly merge the two. We do not see that there's a time for work and there's a time for rest. And God has created the balance, and if you do it His way, it works magnificently. But we always try to do it our own way. We distort our work. Now, work in recreation, that is, recreation, you might put a hyphen in there, see, the work in the recreation is different. See, we do not see man in his dominion, says Hebrews chapter 2, but we do see Jesus in his dominion, crowned with glory and honour, and all authority given to him. If you want to see man as he is meant to be, look at Jesus, for that is what you see. And if you have come into relationship with Jesus, then you are a person who is being restored back to the created order, back to as you were supposed to be in the garden. That restoration work won't take place until the final day when Christ returns, but it is already in process now. And that process now affects your work now, because your work in the Lord is not work that is in vain. You'll work differently now, because you serve Jesus. And so you find passages like Colossians chapter 3, which warns you not to be a man-pleaser, because you're not working for the man, you're working for the Lord. That is for whom you're working. You now can start exercising that position of dominion that you had beforehand and that you lost when you were kicked out of the garden. And so your work now can take on the values of Jesus. And so you're instructed to do honest work with your hands. Ephesians chapter 4, you're not to be a thief anymore. So that's an inappropriate thing. Nor are you to see your work and labour as meaningless, 1 Corinthians chapter 15, about verse 58. Not meaningless anymore. There's actually point and purpose in it. And the way in which you work will reflect your newfound godliness. And so the whole nature of work gets transformed as Christians. Now our problem is that we're still in the process of recreation, and we keep on slipping back to the work after the fall feeling. And so on Monday we say, oh, I don't want to go to work again today. Not realising that here is my opportunity of serving Jesus. So a Christian can actually have a completely different view of work as he gets to Faith Monday. Now, likewise on marriage. When I was married 7 years, I got a case of German measles. And it reminded me that the seven-year itch is the expression for people's inability to keep their marriages going. And after about 7 years or so, they get itchy and need to go looking elsewhere. And after 7 years, the only itch I got were the German measles. But while that may be so for me, for many people, marriage is a great problem. See, there are all kinds of moral dilemmas today that relate to marriage, aren't there? Homosexuality, the question of rape within marriage. The South Australian government's passed a law about that, that you can now rape your wife. In New South Wales, you can't do it. It's an interesting difference, isn't it? Don't know what you do on the border. Then, too, there's the whole questions of pornography and the use of voyeurism. There are people who question the very nature of the institution itself and want to set up trial marriages. Such a thing's a preposterous nonsense, of course, because the very nature of marriage is there's no way out, so you can hardly have a trial, can you? I mean, you're either in it or you're not in it. If you're not in it, well, it's not a trial of it. If you're in it, well, there's no way out, so there's not a trial. So the idea of a trial marriage is the greatest absurdity that's ever come. It's like the stupid phrase, victimless crime. I know what they're trying to say, but it's a stupid phrase. And if it's a crime, then there's victims. If it's not a crime, then there's no victims. You can't have it both ways. We use silly words. Trial marriage is a load of rubbish. However, there is that idea. Then there's the whole idea that we don't marry at all. We just have de facto marriage. Not ever de jure marriage. You might actually take out the certificate that it'll be better somehow if there's not a piece of paper binding us. Or indeed, there's the whole idea of just living in a commune and sharing with each other freely in different ways. Not that all communes are set up that way. Or there's the question of divorce and remarriage and remarriage and remarriage. And of course, we're a society that is now terribly hung up about sex, so that we can't enjoy a joke unless it's sex, we can't enjoy a TV show unless it's got sex in it. Indeed, we're hard-pressed to even read a newspaper unless there's a fair spattering of sex to keep us interested from one page of advertisements to the next. Now, this kind of society is one that is very sick on the subject of marriage. We don't want marriage, we dislike marriage, we're consistently knocking marriage, it's a hopeless institution, it doesn't work, it fails. But yet the marriage rate keeps soaring, so that we keep on having people racing off and getting married. And we can't find a system that actually raises children any better. And we keep on going in for it, although we knock it. Now, what's marriage in the garden? Well, before the fall, the system is set up quite clearly. I'm talking about marriage, by the way, not weddings. Two things are quite different, right? Weddings is when two people make a contract together to be married. But marriage is when one man leaves his father and mother and cleaves to his wife and the two become one flesh. That is, it involves setting up home together in a sexual union that is not to be broken. I don't take one night in the backseat of a Volkswagen as marriage. That is one night in the backseat of the Volkswagen. That is not marriage. It's got to do with setting up home together in a sexual union, with or without the wedding certificate. Now, the marriage in this passage is seen in a series of phrases here I've used, words I've used. Firstly, it's utility. The aim of marriage in this chapter is fellowship. You see in verse 18 that God views man as a social being, and therefore man alone is unsatisfactory. He's insufficient, for he is created as a gregarious being, a society being, and therefore needs society. And so God creates the animals for him in the next paragraph, but none of those animals will meet for him the need for society. And therefore it is that woman is created as the helper to man, that is, the one who is appropriate to man. Now the animals are created to help man, but none of them are appropriate to him. None of them fit. None of them are apposite. None of them really are in any way equal to the man. But the woman is created for the fellowship with man in his labour as the Lord of the garden. That is the purpose for which she is created, for fellowship. That, by the way, is an interesting thing, isn't it? She's not created for procreation in that chapter, is she? She's created for fellowship. That is not to say that procreation is not part of marriage. It is. But that is not the reason for which she's created. She's created for fellowship. And the necessary parts of that fellowship follow on. She is similar to the man. 2:23, bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh. The Hebrew word for man, which I'll anglicise for you, is ish. For woman is isha, right? Just like you get your English words man and woman, the two are clearly related. The ah ending in Hebrew means to come out of. So that the woman is actually come out of man. They are one and the same kind of being. They are bone of bone, flesh of flesh. Same stuff. Equal, as the animals are not equal. So there is a similarity between them. Next, there is also a diversity between them. Because fundamental to the fellowship they have is that they are the fellowship of two different people. They are not the same person. They are two different people. And so they call male and female. So he leaves his parents for the female. The nature of the fellowship then is a nature of complementary beings. Not identical beings. Similar, but not identical. I wish Jermaine Greer and some others would learn this, because they actually wanted to make the women into men, which is a terrible thing. The last thing in the world I want to do is to marry a man. Bad enough I've got to live with one. Only myself. Let alone marry another one. There is a tremendous advantage in the difference, as anybody who's slightly normal would know. Great advantage. We all like talking to the member of the opposite sex rather than our own sex. Always find more interest, more sympathy, more empathy with the person of the opposite sex. Great problems. The diversity is a marvellous diversity. It actually is enriching to our experience that we are different. Fancy wanting everybody the same. What a terrible stupidity. Further, the marriage is one which is of unity. Just to run backwards, you see. You've got two, yes, but when you add the two together, you get that very interesting mathematical equation, which is so hard for people to understand, that 1 plus 1 equals 1. You see, we silly people are caught up in a logic system which says you can't have a logic system like that. That's why you have trouble with the Trinity too, isn't it? Because there you add an extra 1 on, 1 plus 1 plus 1 equals 1. But that is the way the world is, that one man, one woman equals one true man. That is the nature of it, that the relationship between the two is so close that you can bind them together and say they are one. And that, of course, shows the terrible horror of splitting them apart. That what God has joined together, man must not put asunder, must not rent asunder. So there is unity. And that unity is such that there is priority over every other human relationship. So he even leaves his father and mother in order to be one with his wife. And again, can I encourage you, especially those of you who are trying to marry on the cheap, don't live in the garage underneath the house. You need to leave mother and father. And you need to leave them mentally, and you need to leave them physically, and you need to leave them economically. You need to leave them and become one with your partner. However, after the fall, men and women cannot live like that. We are unable to do it. And so in chapter 3, verse 16, we read, "To the woman God said, I will greatly increase your pains in childbearing. With pain you will give birth to children. Your desire will be for your husband, and he will rule over you." You see, the break in the fall of man, affects for the woman the relationship with her husband, affects with the man his relationship with his work. Those things are carried through into chapter 3. And instead of loving and cherishing his wife, she will now desire him and he will dominate her. That now becomes the context. That he will now rule not in the service of love, but in oppression. And so, dissolubility of marriage becomes a necessity. Deuteronomy chapter 24, verses 1 to 4, divorce is permitted. And we're told by Jesus in Matthew chapter 19, divorce is permitted because of our sinfulness. Because we're now sinful people, we are unable to live one man, one woman for all of their life. Because of our sinfulness, we do not live in that harmony and that unity whereby man and woman can be living in nakedness before each other without shame. We now live in shame. We now live in oppression within our families. God hates divorce, Malachi 2:16. God hates divorce. That is not the way in which the world was created to be. It's not the way in which we're to be. He commands strictly that we're not to commit adultery and to break that relationship. Strictly we're told that in the Ten Commandments. And that's never to be varied. And of course, people use the divorce escape as a way in which they commit adultery. So you don't have lots of different lovers, you just have them one after another, all legalised. I understand that Mickey Rooney's just on number 8. Marriage in recreation, though, takes us even a step further. Because in Ephesians chapter 5, I also understand Mickey Rooney's been converted and heard him interviewed the other night and say how he regretted his marriage record. Marriage in the recreation, you see in Ephesians chapter 5, that marriage is a great mystery, that the idea of two being one is a symbol of the relationship between Christ and his people. And Paul takes it a step further and says it's a typology too, that the husband must treat his wife as Christ treated the church. That is, he must be a loving lord, whose lordship is exercised by the way in which he loves, the way in which he serves as her slave. And the wife must submit to her husband as the church does to Christ. That is, she is created to be his helper. She is created for him, says Paul. He wasn't created for her. She is created to help him in his labour, not to usurp his dominion, which she tries to do in chapter 3 with fairly disastrous results. And that marriage is to be held in honour by all, in Hebrews 13 verse 4. So we have in chapter 2 of Genesis the setting out of two ways. You have presented God's perfect garden with people living in harmony with God, in harmony with each other, in harmony with the world that they're in, the garden they're in. And that places man in his context in relationship to God, in relationship to the garden in terms of service, the lordship of work, in relationship to his wife in terms of service again, and that harmony and fellowship that they should have. But in it, God is setting two ways to live, or rather one way to live, one way to die. You care for the garden, you look after it, and you live it my way, or you disobey me, and in the day in which you do that, you will surely die. There are the options. Because man has chosen the option that they have, because they chose to become the gardeners in their own terms, eating the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, so they distorted their relationship with God, they destroyed that, so they destroyed their enjoyment of work, and so they destroyed their relationship with each other. And being eaters of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, we still muck it up. However, in Jesus Christ, we can start having our view of work restored, and we can start having our view of relationships with each other restored. Let's close in prayer, shall we? We thank you, Father, for your creation. We thank you, Father, that you have made us the way we are. We pray you'd forgive us for what a mess we have made of it, and pray that you would indeed work this great miracle of recreating us, so that in the end we may be in that garden setting once more, and that even now, Father, as we head that direction, that you would change us, so that in our relationship with our work, our relationship with each other, and our relationship with you, we might be being restored into the very image of Jesus. And we pray it in Jesus' name. Amen.